Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
On the inside.
Well, then I think we're ready to go, guys.
That's what counts.
Are you ready?
I mean, I could be.
You could be. Mark, you good?
Sure. How are you going to like structure this? How are you going to like start it off? And then,
no,
like,
we're just going
to
start.
Right now. We already started.
Yeah, we started. We're recording. Started.
We're just doing it.
Where are you
we're
at?
Just doing it.
Doing it hard. I was supposed to be clean.
That's supposed to be clean. That's our first one. You didn't know any better.
Sorry, audience.
Well, so welcome to Real World Theology. Real World Theology, the first episode.
R-E-E-L.
Yeah,
that's right.
I had to think about that for a while. I'm not going to lie. It took me a couple times thinking about it. And I think I actually saw the Facebook event for the first one. I was like, oh, wow. I missed that one.
I like how it just... kind of, it's like the spirit came upon you and you're able to interpret the tongues that I was typing.
I would say that the spirit definitely came upon me in that moment. So.
Well, I am, I guess, the host, Mikey. You may know me from such films as Zach Brannigan Goes to the Place. But I'm joined today by Mark. Mark is a fellow podcaster on another podcast I do, Let Pylons Be Pylons. He's also a man of many talents, a local musician, amateur screenwriter / aspiring filmmaker.
I make films now, but I'm aspiring to be greater with them.
Yeah, we all aspire to be great, just like Kirk.
Oh.
Tie-in.
Tie-in.
Also joined by Griffin. Griffin is a comic guru based on my own...
based on your assumptions.
Yes, based on my assumptions.
Your assumption of what I know.
based on comparative knowledge.
Okay.
So
I can agree with that.
He's also a writer. He has a very nice blog that I like to follow. And he is also a local musician. And swell guy.
Swell guy.
Swell guy wasn't written down, but I threw that in just for you.
Gentlemen.
Today we're going to tackle in the first episode Star Trek Into Darkness. So we're just going to throw something light out there, nice, fun, clean.
Into lightness.
Yeah, into lightness.
Into lightness.
We're gonna redeem it. Lots of other very Christianese words.
Please don't use those words.
Please don't ever.
Griffin will walk.
Even
out.
In life.
He will walk. Out.
I will leave.
I will
straight up walk.
I will take my computer and I will go home.
I understand. I guess just to jump right into it, what we're going to try to do here is you heard in the intro that there was some we have a belief that there's a worldview expressed in every single movie, and J.J. Abrams has done nothing to disappoint us in this venture. So what we have here is a movie where we could turn off our brains. We could see some explosions. We could hear people yelling, "Con," but we know there's more going on in the background. So I've got two guys who were very up to speed on film to help us out and kind of extrapolate some of those things. So one final word of warning: if you are listening to this, there will be spoilers.
Absolutely.
Yes.
If you haven't seen this movie by now, it's your own fault. You should have gone to see this movie.
Yeah,
fair warning.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about all aspects of the film, including who the bad guy is, big reveals, plot twists, et cetera, et cetera. So if you don't want to know that, turn this off, go watch the movie, and then turn it right back on because this is going to be awesome. So going so left awesome. To right, left to right, even though no one can tell which one's left
Who's
or right,
left?
I could be lying. My left or your left? Griffin, tell me what you liked about this movie.
I have literally watched everything that Abrams has done, starting with Felicity all the way up until Star Trek. I will see everything that he's touched.
Even Felicity.
and honestly, it's not because I think he's a great creator or a great writer, but because I legitimately just enjoy what he puts out. He puts a lot of effort into it. And stylistically, I've watched his work grow and at this point it's like really staying true to form of what is expected of him. Like, mm-hmm. So people expect currently everybody just thinks like, oh, he does lens flares. And I'm like, yeah, but he
does do a lot of lens flares.
He does
be
it
fair.
He does, to be fair, he does do a lot of lens flares, but to be fair, his lenses, he uses the lens that does that. It's like, it's that's his preference, is like, I want to use this one lens. Whereas some creators use only Canon EOS, you know, cameras, and that's all they will ever use because they're like, I want that stylistic thing. So what I liked about this movie is just that it was an Abrams film. It was what I expected from him from watching the first one. He really didn't change a lot stylistically in the way that he went about telling the story, which I guess he didn't really write. I'm sure he was involved in the story making process, but that wasn't really all him. It was a lot more Lindelof and other creators. But that being said, I did really enjoy the story and the way that he took turns that I didn't expect, mm-hmm. and then took turns that I did expect. Like, I wanted Khan to be in the movie. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people are like, I didn't want Khan, especially if it was going to be Benedict Cumberbatch. But I was like, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
So what I liked about the movie was that I really enjoyed the relationship between Spock and Kirk in this movie much more than I did in the last one. I liked the fact that they kind of got along but didn't get along, mm-hmm. and kind of like jokingly argued. And I liked watching Spock and Aurora like deal. And also a lot of that comes with, I read the comics as well. And so there's a different story that's happening behind the scenes of this movie that is connected to this movie that was written by and handled by a lot of the writers of this movie.
There you go.
That many of you will probably never see, and that's okay. mm-hmm. But if you do want to come see it, let me know. but yeah, I mean, there's just so many things behind the scenes that I knew kind of going in that most fans won't ever realize. And that same thing with the last movie too. So it's cool.
So safe to say that you did enjoy this movie.
I did enjoy this movie as like, I like in the sense that I didn't leave there going like, man, I hated that. Like I just enjoy Abrams stuff. And
is that your voice? Like when you hate something, you just go,
man, that was the worst. so it's safe to say that I did enjoy this movie. Yes, obviously with every movie, I'm like, there are things that I would probably change about that, except for Place Beyond the Pines, which you should go see that. that is one movie I will never change anything about. But yeah, I mean, it's safe to say that there are things that I'd be like, I wish that was kind of different. Mm-hmm. But for overall, I like this movie.
Okay. Well, Mark.
Yes.
Same question to you.
Oh, I was not expecting that. No, I was. I liked it a lot. Funny enough, I had, you know, I read a lot of movie blogs and websites and stuff like that, and I had kind of followed the whole, like, is it going to be Khan? Is Benedict Cumberbatch really Khan? I mean, they showed a picture when he was in the brig, like one of the, you know, preview pics for the movie leading up to it where he was John Harrison. And so there wasn't really, I mean, they did a really good job of hiding the fact that he was Khan. I saw it on opening weekend, so there wasn't a whole lot of spoilers out there. I honestly didn't know for sure or not if he was going to be Khan. And that's when, and I honestly discovered it in that scene where he says, my name is Khan. And I was just, I was really excited. That
was bravado.
That
was bravado.
Well, not quite earlier. Because yeah. I mean, he was like, I've got 72 reasons.
Oh, yeah. I knew going into it. But like, it was, you know, that was a nice revealing moment mm-hmm. for me. So I like Abrams. I like the stuff that he's done. I like his style. You know, I am a Star Trek fan from old. I, you know, grew up watching Next Generation and watched Deep Space Nine and Voyager and all those. And this, you know, and I felt the same way about the first movie. This movie and that movie are not so much, you know, going that way. They're more going towards the popcorn, you know, summer movie blockbuster. And they're pushing it, you know, just as much for an audience who knows nothing about Star Trek and really cares nothing about Star Trek as much as they are pushing it for the Star Trek folks. So I actually went into it thinking it was going to be less of a Star Trek movie than it actually ended up becoming. And I was surprised at how well they handled the universe of Star Trek and everything like that. So I really enjoyed it. I thought they did a good job balancing the action and everything. And overall, I just thoroughly enjoyed the experience of watching the movie.
Well, I think both of you have now hit on one of the key elements to breaking down this film, and that is the argument that I heard a lot after the first reimagined Star Trek movie, but now even more because I think it's actually more of a debate now. You know, mm-hmm. is this a J.J. Abrams movie? Is this just like action, you know, every 10 minutes we have an action beat, you know, awesome explosions, cool camera angles? Or is this a Star Trek movie? Is this, you know, is this a morality story with, you know, the space peace corps, you know, mm-hmm. going around helping everyone, living, you know, living the Federation, even though I guess during this time the Federation is kind of a fledgling organization. It's not quite what it is in Next Generation in the shows, or Deep Space Nine. But, you know, giving that, like, everyone live in peace and harmony. Oh, we also have torpedoes if you don't want to do that. Yeah. So I mean, where do you guys land on that? Because to me, when I saw this film, I was like, wow, this is almost a Star Trek movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, sprinkled in with some jumping from car to car, flying through the air, punching people, you know, like this seems almost to harken back to a Star Trek movie.
Right. I think maybe we need to clarify a little bit more what a Star Trek movie is. I mean, I think for me, a Star Trek movie, because I mean, I think you can even go back and look at the original series Star Trek movie, the Next Generation movies, and you can bounce back and forth. Some of these elements are not Star Trek movie-ish, but some of them are. And I think in order to be a Star Trek movie, you really have to hold to some of the things that they held to in this movie. You know, they talked a lot about the Prime Directive at the beginning. I thought they dealt really well with the Klingons. You know, the Klingons, you know, just for your some Star Trek backstory, you know, in between the original series and Next Generation, went through a whole time. They were, you know, at war with the Federation at first. And they kind of, like, makeup wise, I thought it was a good choice because, you know, the funny things on the top of their head that makes them Klingons, you know, were kind of the backstories. They kind of had an evolution because their first appearance in the original series, they didn't have any of that on there. They just kind of were different looking. Anyway, so I thought they did a lot of things with that, and, you know, with the Khan, and you know, obviously this is a almost an adaptation of one of the episodes from the original series called Space Seed. They talked, you know, the nautical themes, the morality themes were there. So I thought it was a Star Trek movie. I mean, did you agree with that? I mean, are you a Star Trek kind of?
I'm not adherent? As much. I'm not a purist on Star Trek because I was never a Star Wars guy or a Star Trek guy. And I know that's kind of like in nerd world, that tends to be you're either one or the other. It's it's kind of like you're a Marvel or a DC guy.
You chose the third way.
Yeah. I just didn't. I didn't like my dad. I remember my dad watching Star Trek a lot whenever I was a kid, but I never really like got so into it that I was just like, oh, okay. I like the bald guy.
Picard,
which that's like the David Tennant of the Star Trek world. That's what I discovered is like he's most people's favorite.
So it really depends on who you talk to.
Well, I know. I get that.
I've got some people that I know who are just all about like Commander Sisko. And I'm like,
can't be serious.
I was like, they're like, but that flair he brings, it just brings that.
Don't tell epicness. Me you have any Janeway fans.
Oh, actually, well, I've found zero Janeway fans.
Okay, good.
And it's like that episode of Community when they have the one female Inspector Spacetime.
Yeah.
It's like, she's the worst, but not because she's a woman, just because she's the worst.
It's great.
But yeah, I mean, that being said, I didn't really have as much of the backstory, and I love that this movie told a lot more about that because I think in the first one, I think if you had never seen Star Trek, any Star Trek shows or movies before, you would assume in the first one that these are guys flying around in these space mobiles that have weapons on them. They are a wartime, like they are a war fleet. Like that's what their goal is to battle. Mm-hmm. I think if you had seen it, like I think in this one, they really approach that better in saying our first mission is to explore. We don't interact like our first mission. And I think I wonder if maybe like Abrams or the writers in general got flack for that because that was the first thing they did was they delved into that and let you know we are not supposed to touch anything that's going on. We're just supposed to explore. And I like that they got at that right, like very quickly. And at the same time, I feel like if I'm going to go see, I think after the first one, they couldn't just make it they could not make it Space Seeds with like a straight forward, like, no real like huge action sequences episode because I just went and saw the first movie and there are worlds exploding and like people crying and like battles happening on the Romulan warship. Like these are things that are mining ship and these are things that are important to know about, like, I think they realize, okay, for the public, we have to do something exciting.
Yeah, that's what, I mean, and that's an important point to make if you're comparing Star Trek itself to, like, the type of movies that they're putting out. Because, you know, I think Brandon Braga was a producer on The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine and Voyager. And, you know, recently after the success of the 2009 movie, you know, there was, you know, this J.J. Abrams explosion of action and just really exciting. People were like, well, are they going to bring a series back? And his basic, you know, response to that was, if people are okay with what Star Trek actually is as a series, it can come back, but it's not what the movies are, because the movies are made for a general public. So the movies are very much different from the series, because the series was a set, was just every episode was a morality play. It was just a morality tale, every episode it done in an interesting way with a sci-fi setting. So in the movies, and I think all of the movies, you know, just like you said, like Wrath of Khan, all the, you know, Next Generation movies and everything, they were very action-oriented because they wanted to appear to a larger audience, because ultimately you have to make money. So you can't just have a morality play for 2 hours, you know, it just doesn't work as well. And so if you put it in a series, I think now you could do it more action-y, more like a Falling Skies, or like a, maybe like a Game of Thrones type, like a, of set.
But like a Firefly, is that maybe what you're looking for?
Firefly. That's I'm just spouting off stuff here, guys. I'm not a Firefly purist. Maybe, oh, okay. I actually probably am, yeah, but should, I should be.
I should be. We all should be.
Yes, we should have a Firefly episode. Anyway.
Who says we won't?
Yeah, I'm going to say the possibilities are endless.
Boy. I'm taking bribes ahead of time when we do Serenity. Who's going to get to be on the panel? I might have to expand it to three guests.
Battle royale. Yes. To see who's going to be left out.
But I mean, this was kind of towing that line as all the Star Trek movies kind of have to. So I thought they did a good job with it.
Well, honestly. I mean, but what you've just said, like, and what the producer's pointing out is, and something that I want to explore is, why can a series not really exist anymore? What has shifted in basically the worldview of the general public, or at least, you know, the American audience, which is the one who's not receiving this quite as well as the rest of the world, where they need this J.J. Abrams infused action movie. They need, you know, don't give me morality tales. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I find that in this world, almost post-postmodern world now, we get more and more to my truth is relative. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone has their own truth. And because of that, everyone kind of has their own shared, generally agreed upon morality. So I can see why, like, the Next Generation, you know, something like that doesn't succeed anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to get a series of morality tales, and people are like, either I already know this, or, well, you can't really tell me that's wrong because X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. You know, so why do we have J.J. Abrams even trying to harken back to more of a Star Trek story?
I mean, it's a good question. I mean,
does it resonate with you?
As a Star Trek story, or just as a story?
Well, I mean, in any way. I mean, like, when you see this, did you like it more than the, or I think we can all agree that the first reinvention of Star Trek was more of a J.J. Abrams film, less of a Star Trek, you know, classic Star Trek tale, more of an action movie set in the Star Trek universe.
Yeah.
This one kind of at least was 50-50.
Yeah.
So if the general public is trending in that action movie direction, they want less truth. They want less thing. Then why are we going back that direction?
But I think what people, you know, I think the action is that the faster pace and the bigger explosions and the better looking CGI. I mean, that's just, I think it all is kind of a product of technology. We are a mile a minute culture. Information is in our hands, in our pockets, on our phones, that kind of thing. So I think series, you know, look at what Netflix did. I mean, people gobble up series, whole series at a time. They don't wait weeks anymore. And, you know, there's so much more access. So I think movies just have to get bigger and faster and shinier. But at the same time, you still have to have something that resonates. I mean, I think for it to be a really good movie, You have to have something that resonates. And I think Kirk is a believable hero that people, I mean, look how long Kirk has been a character. I mean, since the 60s. I mean, he's lasted this long because he is a, you know, people like his bravado, people like his chip on his shoulder, but he's also flawed and vulnerable and he makes sacrifices for his friends. So I think that resonates to anybody, no matter what package you put it in.
Yeah, I mean, this is a discussion that you and I have had recently when talking about comics. Whenever anybody looks at the market share in the comics industry, mm-hmm. most people may be surprised to know that Marvel and what Marvel does with the characters they have makes much more money than what DC does with Batman and Superman, which is surprising because everybody loves Batman. Like, there are very few people who are like, I don't love Batman. Batman is the greatest character, one of the best ever. But the reason that Marvel gets the market share is because Marvel is a story of a bunch of flawed people who are really messed up. Like Tony Stark, Iron Man, is an alcoholic. Like, he sleeps around a lot. Like, he does a lot of really stupid stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, Thor has like Spider-Man. Serious daddy issues. Spider-Man, like, let's not even get into the fact that he has like killed more people accidentally than I care.
Yeah, that's why Spider-Man 2 was so successful as a film, because it was all about him not wanting to be Spider-Man.
Yeah. And that's where, like, it's the fallen people trying to make it and trying to be good and trying to like just do the right thing. Whereas DC is like the people who have everything. Like, Superman is perfect. And, like, mm-hmm. if Superman's on your team, you win. The movie's over because he can just, like, throw the atomic bomb into the atmosphere at, like, the perfect placement so that way it never touches or intersects anything. Like, that's Superman to you, ladies and gentlemen. Like, that happened in stories. And so I think that that's where this movie resonates with people, because, like, I can get with Kirk. Like, I'm like, I understand why you want to shoot. Shoot him with a torpedo. Like, mm-hmm. I understand why you just want to kill that guy. But I think that that's where my favorite moment in the movie came, was whenever he was like, I will take a boarding party and I will land on the planet. I will put him in handcuffs and I'll bring him back. Mm-hmm. And then whenever they get back and Khan is basically kind of like goading him, and he turns around and is like, give me a minute. And I think that that's where those are those moments where I'm like, you are a believable character, mm-hmm. because whereas Spock gets angry and beats himself up for getting angry, Kirk gets angry and feeds it, because that's humanity. Like, I don't get mad at myself for being angry unless someone else does. Like, I'm sure unless your wife like looks at you and is like, Mikey, stop it. Then you're just going to be like, I'm angry and I'm just going to feed this anger, mm-hmm. because I'm frustrated. And that's what Kirk does. But but Spock does the opposite of that. He gets angry and then he smacks himself on the hand for it. He's like, stop it. Stop being that way. Don't be that way. Right. And I think that that's where the Kirk is me, Kirk is you. And I think that that's where like I can get with that. And I also there's part of me that wants to be that and be willing to die.
Kirk might be you, but I'd rather be Picard. I don't know.
Well, I'm just kidding. I like where you're going. And, well, I partly don't like where you're going, because you basically ruined half of my spiel for when we do the in-person Avengers thing in July.
Oh, yeah.
That's like half of my spiel for the pre-Avengers deal. So I'll just play. This is Griffin.
Talking
about the Avengers. Just listen to this and then we'll watch the movie.
And you notice, I mean, for the history of comics, I mean, Superman eventually died. You know, they had the Superman death. I mean, they brought him back, but like, you know, that was kind of an evolution of like Marvel was doing so well, I guess. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not a comic book historian or anything, but, you know, that Superman didn't die until what, the 90s, was it?
It was the 90s. And that was a point whenever there was a time whenever Marvel was doing it wasn't always this way, like the way it is now.
Yeah.
Because there was a time whenever Marvel was doing the same thing of having these great characters that were doing these great things. And that was also the time whenever they were having to publish their books through DC.
Right.
DC was putting a Marvel stamp on it, but actually getting them printed. Mm-hmm. And so there's this really strange like ebb and flow. And this is what the industry does. Like, it is an ebb and flow thing. And I'm confident that at some point it will change back to DC's way. But right now, currently, what you see in the movies is is true to form, that Marvel movies are better. Like, I would say outside of maybe The Dark Knight Return or the Dark Knight, with like the second mm-hmm. Nolan film, mm-hmm. Marvel movies on the whole have been much better.
Yeah.
But is that because they've got better filmmakers, or is it because, I mean, because, you know, all of the Nolan films dealt with, you know, flawed, you know, people and morality and you know, so all of that was there. And, you know, like, yeah, I keep thinking about Spider-Man 2 because I wrote it on my little thing here. But like, you know, him dealing with that, and, you know, I think it that was a successful movie, you know, in part because it was done so well and the action was amazing and the CGI for that time was just great. And, you know, they had great actors and everything. I think all of those things combined. But when you get to the heart of the story, you still have to have a story. I mean, because, you know, there have been movies that look fantastic, but the characters are wooden and they don't.
Fantastic.
Four. I was about to say the Fantastic Four, you know, something like that, or where it doesn't resonate. So, I mean, you have to have a resonance of some kind. I would say,
well, but doesn't that account for the ebb and flow? It's not just like the market doesn't wildly shift for no reason. Couldn't we, without too much, you know, room for error, infer that, I mean, as a society, something in us is shifting,
mm-hmm.
like we're desiring a certain type of tale,
yeah.
you know, and being in a place now where, like I said, especially in America, you know, one of the reasons that so many people resonated with Iron Man was because, you know, he realized he was messed up, because we could all generally agree, no matter what your background, that he was doing pretty selfish things. Mm-hmm. But then he decided to turn himself around and be a better person. It was like, yeah, he made a choice and he can be a better person.
So can I.
Yeah. You know, and
I think,
you know,
people like to see rich jerks do charity, you know, like be the hero and like yeah. say sacrifice and, you know, become that sacrifice. If they got all the money, they might as well do some good with it. I mean, I think,
oh, well,
that's part of that flawed, you know, like we want to see somebody, you know, we want to believe that person. We want them to do what we would naturally do. We think we would naturally do in that situation. You know what I mean?
Well, we had, I don't want to point it necessarily out, but there was a, you can't see me doing the quote marks in there, a news network that was recently, kind of disparaging Hollywood, because it seemed like lots of the bad guys in Hollywood films were always like rich millionaire oil tycoons who mm-hmm. were greedy, mm-hmm. and it was just about them. And they were like, why don't they ever tell about the really awesome things that these, you know, rich oil tycoons are doing, you know?
Yeah.
And but there is something resonating with, you know, the amoral person learning a lesson.
Well, you bring up a good point about villains. I think villains have to be believable to a certain extent as well. I mean, you do want the bravado of the villain to be, you know, maybe a little bit more exaggerated than, you know, I think natural people act. But, you know, I think Khan is that. He's that, you know, just Shakespearean type of villain. But at the same time, I mean, why is he doing this? It's his family. He's doing all this, he says, because for his family. And he's this soldier and he's got all these, you know, great fancy things about him, but it's all he's a family man.
Well, and that's where, yeah, because, okay, and I would argue that Kirk is the exact same family man, and Kirk was willing to sacrifice his life for that family,
yes.
and Khan was willing to sacrifice his morality for that family.
And everybody else's life.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is like, you have to think of, like, he was willing to say, morally, I'll do whatever it takes to get my family back in my life.
Absolutely.
And Kirk was saying, like, physically, I'll do whatever it takes to keep them alive. And I think that really, that's why these two, that's why whenever you look at the story, even dating back to space, you talk about, because really there are only, but prior to this movie, there are only really two like hardcore Khan stories. You have Space Seeds and you have Wrath of Khan.
Mm-hmm.
And Space Seeds is kind of that. The reason these characters are so, like, Khan is so loved as a character, and the reason that Kirk is so loved as a character, and their relationship is so loved as a character, and I don't want to continue to get away from, like, Star Trek, but it's the same reason that, like, Batman and Joker are such loved as, like, a villain, like, as a couple together, because they are almost exact same, but yeah. also the exact opposite of each other so many ways.
They mirror each other.
Yeah.
That's a really good, thematically, you know, that's what you want to see. You want to see a balance in film, especially, but in any storytelling, you want to see a balance between good and evil, and you know, right and wrong, and all these things that really makes that gives you that lasting resonance that you that you know lasts a long time. That's why these characters last so long, is because they have that, you know, humanity to them that people like to see and like to connect with.
So we can connect with Khan on such a level that everyone in this room was kind of okay with Khan smashing RoboCop's head.
Yeah.
Peter Weller,
Because I didn't like him.
Well Peter Weller comes into because
we're talking about another
too.
Villain.
I guess, villain. And that's also an interesting thing too that has, and we could talk about that, that's come up in recent movies, the double villain thing that has happened. Like, I feel like that's not normal, like, to have, like, two villains in the movie. You talk about, like, for instance, like, going back, The Dark Knight, you had, like, the Joker, and then you had Two-Face. Even with this, they're, like, you talk about the Avengers, you had Loki, but then you also have, like, the power of the Chitauri in the Avengers. With this movie, you have Marcus, and then you also have Khan. And it's like, this weird thing where it's, like, because we have a 2-hour movie or a 2.5-hour movie in a lot of these cases, we have to throw in another villain because this villain is just going to get old really quickly.
Right.
Would you not think we're doing it for comparative reasons? I mean, if we take a look at the villains in the movie, we have Khan, who at times we can relate to. Mm-hmm. Okay. We go, oh, well, it is probably pretty awful to put like 72 people in torpedoes and shoot them at a planet and get rid of them. That's probably a bad thing, and give somebody, you know,
he has reasons to be angry.
You really want to smash RoboCop's head in because of that, you know? So like, but at the same time, you have a villain that is just evil. Like, at no point does he do anything really redeeming. He even has a chance where that, you know, Kirk's like, you know, it was me, don't take it out on the ship. And he's like, well, I was going to kill your crew anyway.
Well, and so, yes, at the same time though, I think and this is something that I learned in storytelling, everybody has to have a motivation. I mean, or they're just not a character, you know, or a full-fledged character. He had a motivation. He wanted to start a war so that he could justify creating weapons enough to protect the Earth from anything and everything. So he wanted to start a war with these, you know, hidden weapons. Make it look like an accident, or like, you know, Kirk lost his mind and just went angry and all that. I think he did have a motivation. So he's a villain, but he's a villain with a motivation. He's not just all evil. You know, to him, he's doing good, even though it's, you know, in terms of the audience and in terms of the narrative, he's not, you know, doing good. But in his mind, he's doing what he's doing for a cause. So that's what Khan's doing. That's what Kirk is doing. That's what, you know, it's just, do you fall on the side of good or evil?
Well, when I think about a subtle narrative that this movie is kind of just laying on the back burner, just, you know, dribbling at the back of my subconscious, I'm thinking about, you know, we have Marcus, who does have motivation, I think is a strong character because of it. But since I believe that he was portrayed as something that I think people today could all unanimously say, bad guy. He's a bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's not he doesn't listen to his daughter. He doesn't listen to reason. He's got singular focus, and he's so an evil. That's what he's doing. You know, we see the results of these bad guys go in two different directions. Marcus, who technically doesn't really, I mean, on the grand scale, because we're comparing him to Khan, like, really cause that much destruction. Sure, he warps in and, you know, blows a whole bunch of people out of the Enterprise, and it sucks that they're dead.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're talking maybe 100 or so lives lost.
Right.
Because of Marcus. Marcus, we're happy when he gets killed. Uh-huh. We're like, yes, Marcus is dead. That's justice. But Khan, on the other hand, Khan has set off a terror, you know, strike in London, killed tons and tons of people. Then he goes to the magic room where everyone knows they meet, or as we call plot device, and mows down a whole bunch of people. Then, you know, he goes and helps kill more people on a ship. He directly smashes someone's, you know, brains in with his bare hands. Then crashes a ship into San Francisco. And we don't really see the repercussions of this, but obviously is going to be killing, you know,
millions,
hundreds, thousands easily,
yeah.
You know, depending on how populated the area is.
I mean, yeah, but you're talking about like 12-story buildings that were in Starfleet, probably filled with workers, and yeah. He just took out the entirety of the building. And like, this isn't like, yeah, this isn't like the building fell after a couple minutes. No. The building got destroyed. Another thing that I want to point out that's really interesting, the difference between like the Space Seeds and Wrath of Khan specifically and current movie, Khan didn't really get his hands dirty in those movies. And in this movie, he kind of gets his hands dirty.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, way gets his hands dirty.
And, yeah. Like, and that was something I found really interesting in the way that that's another thing, too, that I think has come with the change of what like what we want to see. Like, I didn't want to see that as a fan, as like as enough of a fan that I am of Star Trek. I didn't particularly want to see him like
doing cartwheels and like
squashing people's
big,
heads in,
big mm-hmm. big gun, shooting yeah. Klingon ships down, well, dodging bullets.
Well, yeah. At the same time, the Khan's back from the backstory in Space Seed was, and you know, granted, this is the '60s, so in 1996 he had taken over. Basically, he was part of a, you know, these genetic super soldiers that were created, and they basically mutinied and were, he was like king of the world. I mean, he was like, you know, I don't remember the full backstory, but you know, basically they had to run him out, you know, and that's, you know, I guess in Roddenberry's mind, when he was creating that story, that's kind of where once he was part of that, you know, he was overthrown and they were sent out to space, you know, to just be in, you know, cryogenic frozenness. You know, that's when humanity started to kind of turn to, you know, evolve into what Gene Roddenberry had always hoped that humanity would be this, you know, that understands every culture and just is accepting everything like that. And so that was his backstory. So he certainly got his hands dirty in terms of his history. I mean, he was a genetic super soldier that killed a lot of people.
Yeah.
So, and I think, you know, and to compare the Khans in movies, you know, from Wrath of Khan to this movie, Into Darkness, Khan in Wrath of Khan was all about killing Kirk. Kirk was his great white whale. I mean, that was the whole, you know, thematic parallel was to Moby Dick, and you know, so you know, all that imagery and direct quotes from The Last I Grapple with Thee, the very end when he's you know throwing everything he has at Kirk one last time before he dies. I mean, he was Ahab in that movie. He's not Ahab in this movie. You know, he's just a terrorist almost, but like a very smart terrorist. It's like a, you know,
he's very calculated,
Yeah. Yeah. So, but he's ruthless. So, I mean, there's definitely a difference. And you also understand that Khan in Wrath of Khan was older and a lot of different things had happened to him, been a maroon on a planet that was almost destroyed and everybody died that he loved and stuff like that. So in this one, he's younger and he is still that kind of Space Seed type of guy. So they're different characters almost, even though they are the same person in the, you know, and then we get into the discussion of now we're in a parallel universe that J.J. Abrams has created. And
you mean the Romulans were created?
Yeah.
Because Spock.
Well, the alternate universe that J.J. Abrams created because he wants apparently these movies to be the only Star Trek that people think of, which is part of the reason I don't like J.J. Abrams doing these movies a little bit. But I've enjoyed what he's done, but at the same time, I don't.
But this is the same thing. And real quickly, just for people who don't know, Gene Roddenberry, who we're talking about, is the original creator of Star Trek and wrote the original Space Seeds episode. We talk about Nicholas Meyer. He was the one who wrote Wrath of Khan, and people said a lot of the same things about him that we're saying about Abrams now. Was like, it was very divorced from what, like, he came in and wanted to make it more of an action movie. He, like, more than what Space Seeds was.
Yeah.
And so, and it was also like, people didn't say like, oh, that was a really good, like, just another Gene Roddenberry. Like, Gene Roddenberry didn't have time, so they got like a Gene Roddenberry copy to write the movie. It was like, no, this is a very different creator.
Well, they kicked Gene Roddenberry out.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you want to know what a true Gene Roddenberry Star Trek film is, watch the motion picture.
Yeah, there was
79.
And no one liked it because
it was really long, boring, and all about, you know,
being space hippies.
It's like a morality tale. Yeah.
Well, and like you're saying, I mean, like,
I do like motion picture though.
Well, I like it okay as a general movie, but compared to the other Star Trek movies, I mean.
Oh sure, no, it doesn't compare. Right.
But on what you're saying, Griffin, is like we even read this article. It was commenting on Nicholas Meyer writing his memoir that Roddenberry envisioned Starfleet as not a military organization but a patrolling one, a notion that he considered manifestly absurd. He said for him, Kirk was heading up a space of gunboat diplomacy. You know, just it like the concept that this would actually work made no sense to him. Mm-hmm. That people would just all of a sudden flip a switch. And it's one of the things that I've always had a problem in the Star Trek universe. When I get to Next Generation and they're like, oh, we eliminated poverty in like 20, you know,
yeah,
20
yeah.
whatever. I mean, you can't just
have money.
Well, I mean, and what this does, I mean, and it shows me a lot about Gene Roddenberry. And this is one of the things that I was wanting you guys to chime in on. Like, as much as I love Gene Roddenberry for creating this thing that I have spent tons and tons of my life on, you know, loving, just really getting into learning facts, writing fan fiction, you know, all kinds of things. Gene Roddenberry's vision of what humans could be on their own is something that I can't jive with. I don't see, I mean, mainly because of what I believe. I don't right. believe that inherently any of us will ever not be greedy,
mm-hmm.
will ever not want something bigger and shinier and brighter than the guy next to us. Even if we have a replicator that gives us everything we want, we're just going to replicate something bigger than the guy next door.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, I never understood how they always have money, yet they don't need money.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, how are you trading with the Ferengis, but you never have money?
Yeah. I mean, it, I think for me, I at least growing up when I was watching Next Generation, I knew that and I thought it was kind of strange, but I kind of ignored it because it just, you know, the stories are so good that you just kind of like whatever setting they need to have to have the stories that, you know, I'm interested. But I, you know, Gene Roddenberry, I found a quote of his where he's talking kind of about that. And I guess it kind of speaks to his idea that gave him that kind of worldview, where he says, and he's talking about God. He says, we must question the story logic of having an all-knowing, all-powerful God who creates faulty humans and then blames them for his own mistakes. So Gene Roddenberry likes these, you know, flawed characters, these flawed heroes that, you know, like Kirk that sacrificed themselves for their family. And he has this, you know, idea that humanity can be ultimately good, but it's kind of like he has a misunderstanding of who God is, and at least from our point of view, mm-hmm. from our worldview. And he almost has a Christ-like view of humanity, to where that he knows that they're flawed and that they can't really do better. But he thinks that they will, but it's without Christ. And, you know, we believe that it is with Christ that, you know, that's the best that we can be, is striving for who he is. So, I mean, I think Gene Roddenberry just has a, you know, very humanistic worldview, and that leads to that, just idea that the humanity can ultimately be the best. You know, we can ultimately be God. Because I mean, mm-hmm. you think if you're getting rid of greed and currency and you know, war and all that stuff, I mean, you know, that's basically being God.
Well, I think that's partly where we want to go to with this movie, because the things I think that resonate with most people in this movie are when they're arguing. You know, Scotty's like, I thought we were explorers. You know, mm-hmm. everything of virtue in this movie is about like self-sacrifice and, you know, laying down weapons and being, you know, space hippies, you know, things like that. And those are the things that people are jiving with when they're looking at the movie and they independently judge who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. Marcus is the bad guy because he's a warmonger.
Mm-hmm.
When, I guess, hypothetically, depending on your morality view, you could say he's just trying to, you know, survival of the fittest. You know, he's like, we're going right. to be the fittest. We're right. going to be more fit than the Klingons.
Yeah, he's like, I know they're going to attack, so I need to prepare
yeah.
myself and this world for their attack. So I'm going to create this ship that's four times the size of every other ship yeah. in the Starfleet.
Yeah.
Actually, more than that. I mean, that ship was huge. And
it was a big McLarge ship.
yeah. And, you know, I'm going to create this ship that can take care. I mean, that thing could have swallowed a planet. Like, that thing was massive. And he was like, I'm going to create a bigger thing than the guy beside me. And he was like, I'm not going to have to deal with, you know, four Klingon warbirds coming in to the neutral zone and having to figure out how to take them out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is a winnable test. That was what he looked at it as.
Like, Kobayashi Maru doesn't exist anymore. Yeah,
in his world, he's like, I got a bigger ship than all the people who tried Kobayashi Maru.
Yeah, carrying a bigger stick. Well, I mean, that's the thing. But so we have two competing worldviews here. We have a Gene Roddenberry worldview, which people are getting behind.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, even though the people voluntarily agreeing with the Roddenberry verse, you know, the people are good. They just want to do good things. They just want to live in peace. Ultimately, on a subconscious level, everyone's resonating with the un-Roddenberry,
mm-hmm.
the J.J. Abrams, like, humanity is flawed. Mm-hmm. We're jacked up. We're always going to be greedy. We're always going to be getting drunk and fighting in bars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're always going to be pissed off because we're making the wrong decisions.
Right.
You know, we're always just going to be doing what, you know, like Nicholas Meyer is saying, like, it's absurd to think that we can just float around, you know, being space, justice of the peace, you know?
Right, right.
But so, it's amazing to me that audience people are choosing the world that they would not probably agree to,
mm-hmm.
but they are subconsciously choosing the world where people are going to fight.
Right. Well, it's a movie, and how movies are being made and what movies people are paying to see is kind of a microcosm of that picture. You know, we want the flashy blow 'em up, you know, movies that, And they're moving more and more towards having, you know, less faulty characters almost, you know, at times, and just kind of sacrificing story for, expanse and explosions and epicness, you know, and I think that's where films fail. I think that's once you get away from that they fail. And I think, you know, ultimately it's just like, you know, Marcus in the movie where he's going through, I'm just going to go for big, bad, blow them all up, kill everybody just to save the Earth from, you know, an outside threat, is, you know, that's obviously clearly not the way that you really want to go. The better way is to sacrifice and to, you know, try to, you know, like Kirk, you know, and Spock trying to have diplomacy, that kind of thing. I mean, obviously there's a lot of political themes going on with that too.
What do you mean with drone strikes and?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And killing people without a trial.
No. Whatever do you mean?
Is there an allegory to the world terror?
What do you mean?
Well, I want to shift gears slightly. Okay. And we've mentioned this a lot, and Griffin, you've especially been hitting on this. I want to talk about Kirk. Because we have talked about Kirk as a general character,
mm-hmm.
and basically compared him or almost used, talked about him as if he were the same character in the original universe and the same character in this universe. But I think what is striking to me is that we expect the Kirk of this universe to act like the Kirk of the old universe, when in mm-hmm. fact he's not the older,
yeah.
you know, experience, yeah, you know, experience. He's got people around him now telling him, you know, you have to think about other people first. They're molding him. I mean, you know, not to get too, I guess, you know, straightforward with it, but, you know, in Proverbs it says, like, you know, start children off in the way they should go, and even when they are old, they will not turn from it. And I know we're not talking about Kirk as like a baby,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, he is basically taken, like, Pike's basically become his father.
Yeah.
You know, well, and that's why he's angry, because, you know, okay, this character who has no father
mm-hmm.
for all intents and purposes goes to a bar, makes a mistake. He's offered grace and forgiveness. And mm-hmm. he's like, I want you to come do this thing instead. And I'll give you a better life. I'll give you more. And he immediately goes and does that, and then makes more mistakes, which lead to him being like, he continually is extended like a hand of like, okay, here's a chance again.
Why does that sound familiar?
I know. And so then in this movie, like, he's, you see, okay. So first off, you see that he's learned something in the time between movies. He's learned something. He's good at what he does. He really is, like, and he doesn't go by the book, and everybody hates that except for Pike. I don't think Pike hates that at all. I think Pike doesn't, I think Pike wants him to go by the book so that Pike doesn't have to deal with him making the mistakes and yeah. Hater pissing off everybody else. Sorry for the language. but I think Pike wants him to go by the book because he's like, this is going to be really straightforward. Pike wants him to follow the law. Pike wants him to follow the law because he knows that, okay, the law, the commandments that I've set down before you are good. And you don't have to, and you can still get away with it, and you can still save people's lives. But if you follow the rules, you can save people's lives and still do good things. And so I think whenever Pike dies, spoiler alert, that you have this moment where he's like, I don't have someone that will do that in the way that Pike did, because Spock doesn't do it in the way that Pike did. Spock is very passive. He's honest and like truthful, but he's also like very passive in that he files a report without saying anything to him.
Well, I think that's something very important to point out that you're hitting at. What start as far as the movie is, the writers made a very conscious choice at the 2009 movie to take this and say, we're not just going to reboot it and have the same things happen. We're going to have this thing happen to create an alternate universe. Whether you're a Star Trek fan, you like that or not, that's what they've done. And so they've created an alternate Kirk, an alternate Spock, you know, the old Spock that's somehow still in this universe is Spock Prime. but as they call him.
Optimus Spock.
Yeah. But, you know, it's important to note that, because you're right. They're not acting like the old series characters, because they aren't the old series characters. They've been changed in time and created into an alternate universe. And that is what, that really is important for this film as a film, to show that, you know, because, you know, if you've seen Wrath of Khan, you know that Spock dies. And how does Spock die? Well, he basically saves the Enterprise and sacrifices his life to do so. And you have the scene of them with their hands on the glass and Spock dying, and Kirk is really upset. Well, you have the exact opposite scene in this with Kirk sacrificing himself, which is very much more important for Kirk's character, this Kirk's character, to do. To kind of play out that theme and that growing and that change that's been happening in his character since the first movie. And then Spock is very much different, to where that he's very much less in control of his anger, and that's been a big part of his story. So I thought that was really great about this movie, even though I hated that they had Spock say the Khan line, the famous Khan line. That was just, they just went too far into the campy corniness.
When more people in the theater were laughing.
Yeah, that line. Yeah. But it really, it does set up exactly what you're saying, Griffin, because he does have a very much clearer father figure, whereas the old Kirk had a father that he grew up with, but he was never part of his character. Now he has this very, you know, accented in this movie.
Yeah. Well, and this is kind of inside baseball, what I was talking about earlier with their comics that go along with this. The issue that came out last week is actually called After Darkness. Like, the next Star Trek issue is just After Darkness. So it is directly like right after this. Like, you have the Klingon sitting there being like, this is the guy who came on our planet. We're going to have to kill him. And so, but also you have Spock losing his mind because he's going through, and I forget what the name of it is, and maybe you guys know, and it may be like a series specific thing, but he's going through the ritual thing that he has to do, where he's like, as he grows older, I think he's supposed to like happen every 7 years for a normal
yeah, I know what you're talking about, but I can't.
But basically, he is supposed to, yeah. So he's, but essentially he's losing control of his emotions, and it's supposed to happen every 7 years, but because he's a human, it's happening at a very different point in his life. And he always thought that as a human, or as like a half human, he was like, well, maybe I'm just not going to have to deal with it. But now he is going to have to deal with it. And that's what, like, the series has been working up to this, that he can't control his emotions. And now the series is telling you, here's why he couldn't control his emotions.
Ponfar, for you Star Trek fans, that is what the...
Yeah.
Wait, so are you trying to tell all the Trekkies out there that the next Star Trek is going to be written by Nicholas Sparks? It's really going to be about Spock and Uhura dealing with Spock's emotional problems.
But that's the thing. It's going to be dealt with in the next issue, because he just landed on the planet and this girl walks up with his dad and is like, hey, lover, we're supposed to be married soon, right? And Uhura's like, do, huh?
Yeah.
So,
wow, real spoiler alert.
Whoops.
So, like that, I mean, that's a thing where I just feel like there's a part of me that wishes all of you could just read that and get what's going on, at least behind the scenes with these stories. But at the same time, I feel like in the movie, they didn't deal with it enough to really explain to you why is Spock acting so weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were definitely some things in the movie that really weren't explored enough that they kind of cut corners with. I mean, we talked before about the spaceship crashing into London and, you know, all those...
San Francisco.
But all those people died and you know, there was never really any repercussions with that. No fault. There was nothing discussed about that. And the ending I thought was kind of flat with it just...
You mean when they found out...
They jumped forward a single year and all of a sudden Starfleet's like back in full force after
future,
a year.
Man. They got
future. After a year.
Future cranes.
After a year.
But well, think about this. And I wanted to get into this a little bit later because it starts to derail us a little bit from the actual main topic of the thing.
Right.
But we're getting about that time anyway, so we can do this. The come on, because I want to do this at every movie, because every movie's okay. Got the come on.
Oh, cool, yeah.
Come on, man. I think the con moment is so come on that I don't want to use it as my come on moment. So mine was okay. So Dr. McCoy has basically found blood that can bring people back from the dead.
Yeah.
And so like, maybe that's the thing. Maybe that's why we don't hear it about anybody in San Francisco. Cause he's used this magic blood to cure death.
Yeah, there we go. Come on.
No, wait a minute. We just, we basically brought Kirk back to life. Cause he's the only person that matters. And right. Then we put Khan in a tube, in a closet.
Yeah. Well, and another come on was like, they had to have Khan because as they kind of set it up, they were all basically genetically modified people. So they could have used the blood from somebody else, but we had to have a reason for Spock to go for some reason chasing on foot after Khan on the surface to kind of have a fist fight, which is just not... See, to me, I think Spock, what they did with Spock from the Khan line on through the end of the movie was not very Spock.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because I mean, it was, he doesn't go fist fight somebody because he's angry, which I think is a character of this version of Spock.
You didn't like
maybe.
The Vulcan neck pinch that he kind of was like, ah!
Yeah, no, I did like that. No, I'm not saying the fight wasn't cool and everything. I thought that was
the ultimate WWE moment. That was like the, you've got me in the arm bar, and you're like, you start hulking up.
Right.
He's like, ah! And he fights out of it.
Yeah, no, I that was very anticlimactic, the whole ending. Oh, yeah, ending, very. So, but.
Griffin.
Come on, moment. Come on.
Come on.
Come on. Come on, Griffin. Come on.
I'm trying to actually think for a minute because I was sitting over here looking at other things outside of this conversation. So I apologize to the audience.
I'm sorry when I keep your attention.
Yeah, no, it wasn't that. It was like really exciting things are happening. I don't know. I feel like a come on moment for me was whenever he called Scotty and Scotty was just like, yeah, sure, I'll help you out. I was just like, no, won't. Like, not only are you're like, okay, you just got stabbed in the back. Mm-hmm. Like you straight up told him like, hey, I saved you multiple times here, Kirk. Okay. I saved you a lot. I saved your tail a lot. And you're going to just stab me in the back because you want like revenge and all this crap. And then I'm just going to just answer your call and
Did anyone else notice how there was an overabundance of people who could not use transporters in this for various reasons?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I transported three people from two locations to one pad in the first movie.
Yeah.
You know,
but no, we can't transport him unless we see him.
Yeah. There's too much interference from on the surface from no one being around
2 miles over
the
there.
Building.
Come on.
You know what my come on moment is? The lens flares. He chooses the lens flares. It is not just a lens that he uses. He puts the lens flares in there for stylistic reasons. I did want to say that because it just got on my nerves by the end. But
okay,
back to the point.
Do you have more come-ons?
I could probably sit here and think of some more come-ons. But.
Okay, well then let's end it on a more positive note.
Okay.
All right. And I'll go first, graciously.
Okay. Thank you, Mike.
I won't like... The part in the... I don't want to just say your favorite part of the movie because I think that sells it short. Mm-hmm. I want to say like the part of the movie that resonated with you more than anything else. Because when we were talking about Kirk, I didn't notice this until I watched it a second time. But there's a part, and I can only assume they did it on purpose, there's a part when Pike is talking to Kirk in the bar, and Pike says something, 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 son. And Kirk's eyes, like, they get big droopy dog eyes, like almost looks like he's getting ready to cry right before they get the call that, you know, the bombing happened. Mm-hmm. And like, I could see in that moment that was the relationship, like that sold the relationship to mm-hmm. me. And especially, I could get with Kirk when you juxtapose that moment against when Marcus is talking to Kirk when they're confronting each other.
And he calls him son.
And he's like, listen, son. And he's like, and you can just see Kirk's eyes like,
wow, yeah.
Nope. Yeah, that right there was like one of those things that I think, you know, someone throws in, but like, oh, this will be cool. But like, I'm not necessarily, what's the actor's name? Chris Pine.
Chris Pine, yeah.
Yeah, Chris Pine, you know, he doesn't really, you know, blow me away with his acting ability mm-hmm. necessarily. But those two scenes, I was almost floored the second time I watched it, because now I was watching, you know, able to just take in the specific parts of the story. So that to me, it almost wrecked me.
Yeah, that's so huge.
Follow very that up.
Yeah, I was going to say, follow that up, Griffin.
Come on, Griffin.
I
was
gonna, yeah, really. I think the moment for me was whenever I expect... Okay, so Kirk knows nothing about the ship. I mean, he knows the ship and he like loves the ship. But like when it comes to the engines, he knows nothing about the ship, really. Mm-hmm. And that moment whenever Scotty's like, we have to get in there, we have to do this, we have to do this, we have to do this. Like, this is what needs to be done. And Scotty knows what to do. But Kirk doesn't really know what's going on. Like, he's probably never been in that room. And he probably doesn't know where things are. And he's just like hoping that he can just figure it out, because he just punches Scotty in the face. And I thought that was like the ultimate moment of like, you really and truly didn't want to lose anyone. Like, mm-hmm. your goal was to not lose a soul on this trip.
And he even bragged about it before.
Yeah. And that's the thing is, like, I think that was a moment for me where I was just like it wasn't like the writers made a point that he grieved for every single person that was lost. And right. he felt bad for every single person that was lost because of something that he did. And that was a moment where he could have easily been like, yeah, I'm probably gonna need your help in there, because he did need his help in there. But he was like, nope, only one of us is gonna die, and it's not gonna be you. So
yeah. Yeah, that was huge. I mean, I really enjoyed the sacrifice of Kirk. I mean, I think, I don't know how you couldn't enjoy that, you know, like that's just, it's
even
huge.
Though you knew it was gonna be okay in reverse, but it was still like, it was a good
telegraph the him coming back.
They definitely telegraphed that. I don't know how you couldn't telegraph that though. But nonetheless, not to get too much into that. There was a lot of little moments for me. That's part of what J.J. Abrams does, you know, in his films and his TV. He likes to just kind of have some really nice human moments. And I really thought, I mean, you automatically have the established relationship between Spock and Kirk. But I really liked... I've always enjoyed the scene from Wrath of Khan when Spock dies and they're, you know, against the glass. But this one was, I thought this one was better. And I say that with caution because it's such a huge moment in you know, Star Trek fandom and lore and everything. But I just like that they kind of brought around and that Spock was able to, we got to see Spock in that scenario of like, he couldn't control his anger. Now they went too far with the Khan line. Obviously I thought he could have done the Khan line, but done it in a very Spock way, and mm-hmm. did it in a mocking the original Kirk way. So, but there's that whole, you know, Kirk is like, I'm scared. I have the, you know, quotes pulled up, but he says, I'm scared, Spock, help me not to be. How do you choose not to feel? And that reminded me of the part where he was basically, you know, when Pike dies and he mind melds with him and he understands what he feels. And I thought that was another small moment where he was like, he wasn't thinking words or something. He was just, I felt his fear and anger and frustration and sadness, you know, and I thought that was just a little moment of humanity and emotion that really resonated with me. And then Kirk says, you know, I wanted you to know why I couldn't let you die, why I went back for you. And Spock says, because you're my friend. And I think that friendship, even though it's, you know, it's a Vulcan and a human, it's sci-fi, it's, you know, naturally going to be artificial, it's very real because of how they play these characters and how that they let them progress from the first movie to this one. And I thought that was just a great, just, I really, really enjoyed that scene. Cause I thought it was cool that they were just flipping everything, you know, from Wrath of Khan and everything, but just that they really, really let that moment be what it needed to be.
Yeah. I enjoyed that a lot more the second time I saw it. The first time I saw it, I was pretty upset. I was like, God, they're just flipping the stupid thing.
Yeah.
But the second time when I knew it was coming, I had a chance to be like, okay. You know, I was diving more into like the Kirk character development, you know, him not being the Kirk I'd expected.
Yeah, that, I don't, you know, I don't take notes of the first movie. Mm-hmm. The first time I see it, I take notes the second time I see it. Like if I'm going to like review something or, mm-hmm. or think hard, like I'm like, oh, I'm going to take notes the second time I see something. The first time you're just like, you want to feel the movie.
Yeah.
However you feel the movie, you know, some people get really into it and mm-hmm. some people really just think about like flipping the script on things. And yeah. And I get that. And I think the second time I saw it, there were a lot of things that I think I did get more of angered about the lens flares the second time I saw it. I think I was like more annoyed by it the second time. But at the same time, the second time I enjoyed the writing more. I kind of like enjoyed the script more and felt like it was like I realized the realness and the sincerity of some of the lines and some of the moments and some of the, like, for instance, even something as simple as where Marcus is like, well, my transporter works. So I'm going to pull her over here and still win. Mm-hmm. And I was like, why didn't he, like, they could have easily just had him kill her and just be like the total bad guy. Mm-hmm. But he's mm-hmm. like, nope, I'm not going to be the total bad guy. I'm going to transport her to my ship and fix and do it anyways. And I think that was a small moment that I don't know if every screenwriter would see that out. I don't know if that would be the case. So mm-hmm. I like that. There are things like that that I really like.
They really took time with the writing, I thought. And, you know, whereas a sequel can be very rushed and forced and, you know, oh, we could just flip Khan, the Wrath of Khan around and make our own sequel. You know, they didn't do that. They took time to really, really, I mean, you know, I in the interviews with J.J. Abrams leading up to the me seeing the film, he was explaining, you know, we really tried to make a movie for both audiences, for the Star Trek people and the action people who had nothing, you know, people just want action and nothing about Star Trek. And I kind of rolled my eyes because I was like, oh, this is just going to be a J.J. Abrams movie. It's not going to be a Star Trek movie. You know, I was kind of a little skeptical and bitter about it. But I was really impressed at how they treated this. You know, they made some bold choices. Some of them didn't work out so well, and some of them really did. And mm-hmm. I thought it was a good movie for to be in the Star Trek lore. There Excellent. You have it.
Well, I guess that about wraps it up here. I want to thank you guys for both being here, taking the time to do this.
Absolutely, it was fun.
Taking the time for all that preparation that we went through.
Oh, totally.
And I wanted to give you guys both a chance to, I guess, kind of promote yourself in any way. I mean, because obviously people are going to listen to you. The millions of fans of this one episode podcast are going to, you know, listen to your opinions and really want to follow you. So, Griffin, is there anything that you that you're really working on right now that people could kind of get on board with?
Or? Yeah, I mean, honestly, I've kind of had to put a couple of projects on the back burner for the time being, just because of one of my collaborators kind of being out of pocket for a while. And so the real thing that I like to talk about is just my blog, because I do put a lot of thought into it. So the website is dearcynic.com, and just like it sounds, dearcynic.com.
I'll make sure it's in the show notes too.
Yeah, so that'd be great. And then also just the band that I currently work with Mark Falls. It's cool. I love collaboration in any respect. And that's why I'm like, well, I'm going to wait and finish this up later, because the collaborator that was supposed to be involved can't. And so I'm very much like, I love collaboration. And I think our shows are a lot of that. So you should definitely come out and see us in a couple of weeks, probably about a month from now, mm-hmm. at the Turntable in Jamestown. And then also the Sessions Coffee Shop here in Greensboro, North Carolina, if you are listening locally. So.
Yep, right. That would be the June 27th and June 28th. I am in Falls, and I get to, that's where I kind of like, if I write songs, I get to play them in that band, and collaborate with those guys and make them better than I could ever make them on my own. And that's been a lot of fun. I'm actually in another band where I play drums. It's a rock band called iAnomaly. We're playing some shows this month. You can check us out on Facebook. But I actually am a aspiring filmmaker. I've made some short films, and I have one almost finished. We shot it a couple months ago. It's finishing up editing. It's a little sci-fi, eerie kind of thriller that I actually wrote and co-directed and acted in. So I did a lot of hats on that one. Griffin was our grip, actually, on that one.
Key grip, best boy.
Yep, it's
and if you met Griffin, you know he is the best.
He is the best. He's the best boy. It's called Transmission. I did it in collaboration with a good filmmaker friend of mine, and he has. We're gonna kind of host it on his YouTube site called Mr. Clay Media. That's Clay with a K, K-L-A-Y. You can check that out. We did another film on there, a little zombie movie. It's a little bit different, not for the squeamish, but we had fun with that one. So check that out. It's got some good stuff.
And assuming these gentlemen who are very on the ball with getting me responses via email, get me all the links to these things. I'll make sure that all this stuff's linked in the show notes. So anybody interested in any of these projects these guys have going on, we can get to those. Mark also neglected to mention that he is also the co-host of another star podcast, very world famous podcast.
That's right.
For those of you who are into professional football, Let Pylons Be Pylons is another podcast we both write and produce.
And it's we have a website where you write articles.
We have a mm-hmm. blog where you can read stuff while you're getting ready to download the next episode of Real World Theology.
And or Let Pylons Be Pylons.
And or Let Pylons Be Pylons. So like I said, I just wanted to thank those guys for being here. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Indeed.
Yes,
you're welcome.
Yes, you're welcome.
And we will surely have those guys back on the show again. Hopefully we'll be putting this out roughly once a month to start, to kind of pace ourselves, not to give ourselves too lofty of expectations. I'll be bringing on a couple different guests, get some different opinions, different viewpoints. I believe next month you can expect us to review Man of Steel. So
can't wait to see that movie.
That'll probably be really awesome.
Not even ashamed to say that.
I really think it's going to be great. So if you enjoyed this in any way and or saw the potential that it had, please make sure you go ahead and subscribe. The iTunes feed should be up by the time this is posted, so you can subscribe to Real World Theology through iTunes. You can also go to the website, realworldtheology.com, where I do post reviews and have live events that you can check out. In general, you can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. I know you guys probably had Twitters, but you failed to mention them. So if you get those to me, then I'll get those into the show notes as well. But we're right out of time. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to my guest. And until next time, guys, remember that entertainment is not mindless.